Welcome back to the Out of the Woods Threat Hunting Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Poley.
And I am Tom Kostura.
In this week's segment, we'll break down the stories, tactics, and insights that matter most to threat hunters. So let's jump into the top threat hunting headlines for the week of October 13th, 2025. Tom, what do you got for us this week?
All right, starting off this week, I got an article from Cisco Talos titled Velociraptor Leveraged in Ransom Attacks. So threat actors have been seen abusing the legitimate DFIR tool called Velociraptor to facilitate post-compromise control and ransomware deployment across Windows and VMware ESXi hosts. Operators deployed an outdated version of Velociraptor with a known privilege escalation remote execution weakness, enabling command execution on those endpoints. The campaign progressed from foothold and management tooling to multi-family ransomware deployment. So it was identified that they were dropping different ransomwares like Warlock, Lockbit, Babook, as a couple examples, indicating opportunistic extortion and large-scale impact. Attackers use Velociraptor to stage additional tooling rather than only relying on custom malware, illustrating a trend that we are kind of seeing. I think we can kind of put it in the trend category of weaponizing legitimate admin tools. So some of the technical bullets here that I'll touch on. So the installation and use of Velociraptor is put on the host to allow them to run arbitrary commands and deploy payloads. From the C2 side, there's a download and execution of a VS Code binary that creates a covert tunnel C2 channel for the endpoints. The ransomware is executed on both Windows and those ESXi environments, and then it also demonstrates showing lateral movement into infrastructure services, as well as a hypervisor targeting. So some of the overlap of tools we also see from this is there's additional use of off-the-shelf offensive tooling. So we're thinking common web shells, MPacket's a big one, alongside the Velociraptor to help enumerate and move laterally prior to that ransomware lockdown. They did leverage fileless, I'll put that in quotes, PowerShell scripts as a primary encryptor. And some items of note where the use of encoded commands, which is things we talked about, also things like the different encryption calls, so like the RSA crypto service provider call, just to note a couple things. Another interesting PowerShell script for the exfiltration side, because they did a double extortion in what was reported here, is that of the one specific point of interest is the use of the start sleep commandlet. I thought this was interesting, Scott. And it looks like it was leveraged to suspend script running for given amounts of time, likely to use to inhibit analysis or potentially avoid detection or sandboxing. It was my read on that one. So some of the stuff that I did kind of take note here as like the detection hunt side considerations. So looking for that Velociraptor tool being leveraged, so whether it's processes, agents, installers, things like that, especially if they're uncommon, your environment is a pretty low-hanging fruit, and I think some of the unusual behavior from the tool. So let's say that this is leveraged in your environment for a given reason. Look for that Velociraptor making network connections to uncommon domains and IPs, downloading executables or spawning shells or child processes that are pretty much atypical for those kind of DFIR operations. The ESXi focus, so monitor for unexpected file writes, commands on those hosts, unusual VM guest operations. These are things that we've touched on before when people have targeted ESXi, especially in a given year and some of the recent vulnerabilities that have been out there. Also, you know, identifying those PowerShell behaviors. These are things we talk about commonly. So those looking for the encoded command usage, abnormal commandlet usage, tracking that encryption attempts, you know, those are some things to kind of point on, but, you know, nothing overwhelmingly crazy here, Scott, but I did think the use of the open source DFIR tool, that Velociraptor tool, was something a little bit novel was to talk about and maybe kind of expand on that. Actors are leveraging these things that are just out there that are generally used for good or for benefit, and are spinning them to make them work in their benefit. So what did you think, Scott?
Yeah, I mean, I think the use of the Velociraptor tool is really interesting just because I mean, if you think about a lot of the forensics tools or security-based tools, they're always like high privileged tools. And, you know, possibly in some instances, you may not have to necessarily be an administrator to install them. I'm not sure, because, you know, one of the things I was thinking was, you know, if you're going to install and run a tool that's invulnerable to do other things, if you have the access to do that, why do you need the tool? So I'm assuming there's something else they want to be at, or maybe it's just like an easier form of persistence, because now they can actually leverage that tool for doing other things. But, you know, that's one of the things I think is always an interesting, if not a hunt, kind of a data study. You know, there's a lot of organizations that may not do like application whitelisting or approve software lists, but there's still nothing wrong with just knowing what runs in your environment. And if you have, I mean, most people have the telemetry of just process executions. You can look for very rare instances to get an idea what teams use maybe unique software. That's good when you identify like vulnerabilities that come out that can impact like specialized teams that may have specialized access as well. But then also identifying like weird things that you wouldn't expect to be running in your environment with the shadow IT stuff. And in this case, you know, you're uncovering something that is being leveraged by actual true adversary that hopefully you can kind of pick up on. So, you know, I think that's always a good thing to kind of have in your back pocket. And if you can build something around like, hey, here's all the things that from even this just security monitoring mindset of we can basically approve these things. And so let us know when the lists, something new gets added to a list, for instance, you know, like that kind of approach. It doesn't really cross over into auditing or management per se, because it all depends on what processes you have that kind of come from that. But it's really good insight just to be aware where you might not have those other programs in place. The other thing, I mean, they do kind of some common things. I think that's how they were kind of doing attribution as well. But, you know, using NSI exec to actually install or run from a remote location and via like, you know, a web address as part of the command line there, that's a pretty big easy gotcha, because that's not a common behavior in many environments. So seeing that being leveraged to try to pull down, you know, remote code essentially to execute is always interesting. There's a lot of, you know, bat files that are being run. And I've always found it interesting when you see bat files being run with the CND, the command prompt with the /C argument, because it either something's scripted across the environment, so you would expect to see those in large, right? Like, oh, okay, it's the same bat file existing in the same location across multiple machines. It's easy to say, yeah, that's probably normal. I mean, in this case, you wouldn't necessarily see that, because it is kind of, you know, it wouldn't hit every machine the same way. It might not be in the same location. If it's in a temp location like it is for some of these, also kind of questionable, because that's not a place I would think any administrator would leverage. And also there's a single character, right? We talked about single character executables, but single character files, especially like script specific files like bat files or PowerShell or stuff like that, I think are really good to pick up on. And you know, if looking at, you know, they provided some of the function calls, and one of the things in there, obviously the function stuff you might not see from a logging perspective, because it's something already running and then it can be calling those functions internally, so it's kind of gotten past that initial execution telemetry. But it looks like there's a direct IP call out, right? So and it's not even HTTPS, it's HTTP, which anytime you have HTTP traffic going to an external IP directly, if you have that kind of web log capability, it's also a huge red flag. I mean, HTTPS is also good, you know, worth noting, but I feel like with HTTP, it's kind of like the shortcut way where, like, you know, we say laziness is why we have single character file names. I mean, just trying to stand up a simple web server to push data to or pull data down from, that, you know, it's just straight to an IP. It's not even a real domain there. That kind of a good red flag to run down or look for as well. So I would have to say, like, you know, pretty savvy as far as looking at using what tools are available. And I feel like, was it Nearsoft, right? Nearsoft has a bunch of really cool forensics tools and scanning tools, like for the network stuff, that ransomware actors have been using, like the IP scanner and some other types of tools that are, you know, commonly leveraged. So I guess I'm not surprised, but it is interesting to see Velociraptor because it's more like your EDR type tool. But, you know, historically, that's been the case where sometimes there was a period where endpoints were getting taken over, like antivirus and stuff, to help detonate things or run things. So it's not the first time we've seen that, but very creative use of that for sure.
All right. What do you got next for us, Scott?
So I was going to jump into kind of a traditional one. It's a GB Hackers article. And they're talking about, what's it titled here? It's titled "Hackers Use Court-Themed Phishing to Deliver Info Stealer Malware." So, you know, anything like you would expect to see, there is a phishing email that is, you know, socially targeting, people to try to get them to open stuff. In this case, it must've been Latin America or Spanish, or I guess it's targeting Colombian users in this case. And they're impersonating the 17th Municipal Civil Court, and they have a .svg file that contains embedded JavaScript in it. So when the user actually opens it, it opens a fake portal and lures the victim to download an HTA file, which unpacks a VBS script, which then launches PowerShell. And that will fetch an obfuscated text blob that then decodes a .NET Loader DLL, which is used for reflection to inject async rat, which people may have heard of before, into a MS build. And so that, therefore, the rat's kind of running in memory. It's able to perform reconnaissance, exfiltrate data. It's like your typical rat, and it's been around for a long time, so it's got a lot of capabilities. But, you know, the thing that we typically see, and we've talked about numerous times, is this like multi-stage approach where, you know, things are broken up into multiple stages like this. So it's harder for EDR tools to stitch together all that telemetry to create the context to say, oh, these little pieces don't do anything bad by themselves, are doing bad things together. That's kind of why this is happening this way. But we've also talked about that kind of scripts interpreter chaining, right? So, you know, you have HTA file that unpacks a VBS script that's going to run. So that means you're going to have mshta.exe, which typically runs those web application apps. That's thing in that either probably run W script. It could run C script. I think C script's the interactive version. So it'd be running W script to launch, to execute the VB script, right? Which will then launch PowerShell to then continue doing the PowerShell things that it does. So, I mean, that in itself is like a huge giveaway, right? Of what activity can you see there? And then I kind of got to thinking about it too. You know, it's injecting into MS build, right? And there are some processes, if you're familiar with them, that I would think, and I actually got me even thinking more about, you know, there's telemetry you can turn on when processes terminate, right? And I've always never like saw the biggest value of that. Like, okay, like it's nice to know, like, kind of when things are running, when things stop, and some one-off instances for questions I've had to answer. And I'm like, oh yeah, I wish we had this kind of visibility. But it got me thinking about the injection piece, right? And MS build is one of those processes that shouldn't endure, right, for a long period of time. But a rat, for instance, is something that's supposed to be persistent. Like, it's running and it's going to stay running because it's going to constantly be brokering access or doing things, kind of staying live. So that got me thinking, where if you had that telemetry when certain processes that usually like execute, complete, and close, like MS build would, because MS build used to like compile code, build things, right? I would expect the process wouldn't linger and stay open for a long period of time. And that might be questionable, especially, you know, you start looking at, well, what launched MS build? What are the command line arguments of MS build? Do they even make sense? Like those types of things. So I actually thought that might be an interesting telemetry to potentially track for trying to look for those injected into type of processes. So that was an idea that I had. And then, you know, when you're looking at, you know, async RAT in general, you know, they kind of list through some of the capabilities and stuff to look for. But one of the telltale signs for a really old malware and RAT is its persistence strategy, where it pretty much leverages two. If it already has administrative access, it's going to create a scheduled task. So you should be able to see, you know, creations of scheduled tasks, especially after following some of the other activity. That's, you know, your huge red flag of, you know, where things are running, what to get rid of, like what the persistence looks like, or it will write things to the current version run key in registry, right? That's, you know, old malware 101, right? That's the place to look. That's what's always kind of happening. We see that pretty regularly from week to week when we talk about different types of attacks. So that's kind of my summary of the whole thing and things I pay attention to. But yeah, what was your take?
You know, I like articles like these, Scott, because they, when you see some of the techniques being used that we talk about kind of constantly, it is always, and it will always be like a nice, you know, kind of stretch or a muscle memory reaction to seeing some of the techniques that are leveraged, right? So it kind of keeps it to where we as hunters are always looking for the net new stuff most of the times. Like, we're always thinking about the stuff we haven't tracked before. But when we see articles like this, where you see the same kind of steps an adversary's taking to accomplish a given thing, AMSI bypass was another one sitting in there, the anti-analysis stuff, the basic persistence approaches, like, it's good to have that muscle memory kind of work out, if you will, to say, okay, I need to always consider these things. These ones are basically standard behaviors that I should always think about. So I like that, just because it makes my brain feel happy, if you know what I mean. Yeah. I didn't consider the stuff you mentioned about MS Build. So that was interesting to hear your insight there, man.
Yeah. And you know, it was just one of those random thoughts. I was like, man, you know, if something's going to sit there and persist, there are processes that I know when I'm I run different software for different things and it doesn't like close gracefully and it's still running. And when I'm looking at things while my computer's like running weird or I'm trying to track some things down and I see a process, I'm like, hey, I closed that a long time ago. Why is that still running? Kind of got me thinking about like, you know, that might be a, not saying the stuff I was investigating was compromised. I was more troubleshooting things. But kind of got me thinking like, you know, that is kind of a behavior for most things, unless it's like a running app that requires user interaction. It's pretty much run, execute, close. So yeah, something to possibly look at, I guess.
Yeah, no, very cool idea.
All right. What do you got next?
All right, jumping into an article from Fortinet. It's titled New Steal It Campaign Abuses Node.js Single Executable Application. So the Steal It campaign is, it deploys a Node.js Single Executable Application Loader. So I'm going to refer to it as SEA as we kind of move forward, which is a self-contained binary bundling Node and JS payloads. Mainly to distribute a multi-capable RAT and info stealer. So actors disguise those SEAs as benign apps. So think of games, VPNs, things like that to kind of trick users into running the large single file binary that unpack obfuscated JavaScript into memory. So post-infection capabilities include credential and browser wallet theft, remote access, exfiltration, even ransomware deployment, making it a pretty versatile kind of crimeware platform, if you will. So some of the technical pieces here. So the Node.js SEA packaging. So it's a single exe that contains the Node SEA blob resource with compressed obfuscated JavaScript payloads. Execution occurs in memory after the extraction. So there's a staged unpacking, multi-stage payload. The SEA loader pulls down the JavaScript to decrypt and decompress, then it moves to the dynamic execution of the RAT modules. So your file operations, your RC, data def, all those things happen in the third stage. Obfuscation and domain pieces. So JavaScript payloads are heavily obfuscated in these examples. The C2 domains also rotate and are seemingly moved routinely. There are some artifacts and indicators that I did tag here. So one that it seemed like it did routinely was it wrote to the app data local, and it wrote to app data local error lx slash error.log, and it would log all of the files it pulled to that place. Also, there was a cache, a JSON file, cache.json, that seemingly held the off key linking the victim to that C2. And then there was some common dropper names they were leveraging, save data exe, stats db exe, game cache exe, to kind of follow along with their thematic or their themes. It detects if it's running in a virtual or sandbox environment. I thought this was pretty interesting, Scott, because it was there was quite a bit there. So it looks at things like total system memory, number of CPU cores that are available. It'll match up a host and or username against the known blacklist. It looks for common files and directories related specifically to VMware and VirtualBox. It also checks execution durations, and then it tags it as an analysis environment if that duration is longer than 500 milliseconds. So a couple new things there that I don't remember seeing, or at least seeing recently. It runs other checks too, like it'll pull netstat to get all active ports. It'll do some registry checks for debugger applications. It also runs task list command to list all DLLs that are loaded by the malware, and checks if any of them are related to analysis applications. It does some standard stuff as well. So again, we see some PowerShell commands here to do an add MP preference to bypass the Defender scanning capabilities on any of the files that are downloaded. One item in the payload leverages WScript to generate that VB script inside the startup folder for persistence. So to pull down a VB script, drop it in that startup folder for persistence specifically. It's also seen leveraging an open source project tool called Chrome Elevator, which is basically meant to target Chromium browsers for the various levels of theft that you're looking to go for. A couple things here that I put in the hunting ideas category. The behavioral signs, you know, looking for that parrot process and kind of seeing if you're capable to tag it to the in-memory JavaScript execution patterns or child processes spawned shortly after that SEA execution. And then unexpected use of JavaScript APIs and whatever telemetry you have that might make it visible. File system stuff, alert on creation or modification of that error.log. So that one was, you know, it seems pretty hard-coded into the malware itself. So definitely something that's worth in the short term checking out. What else did I have here? So the hunt on execution chain. So correlate user download events, execution of large PE files with that embedded node artifact, followed by the creation of that error.log. And potentially the outbound connections if you track down through the C2 level. That is a high confidence chain for this malware. And then identifying some of those PowerShell artifacts or behaviors like bypassing Defender. That one's pretty low-hanging fruit. But that's just to name a few things to consider, Scott. Mostly what I really found the most interesting in this article is the depth that they go to look at the anti-analysis stuff. I just found that pretty interesting to see that they were trying to do so many layers of things to avoid detection or avoid being in a virtual environment, which is pretty cool. What did you think?
Yeah, I mean, that was like the biggest piece I kind of picked up on was, you know, most of the time when you see malware trying to like avoid detection, it's more concerned about, is it in a sandbox environment? And in this case, they're more focused on, how is itself being executed, and understanding that there are forensics type tools that will hook things, that will like delay loading certain things, will enter, like, you know, have some controls over some of those things that they're specifically looking for. So it's really truly more of an anti-analysis code than your typical let's avoid, you know, beans and sandbox type stuff. And it's the first time I've ever seen the Chrome elevator, which is a good thing to be aware of. And it seems like it's a pretty kind of easy one-stop shop. Let's pull everything out of the browser that you may want. So it's an open source project on GitHub. And you can see based on the arguments, you know, that it could be potentially related to that but it's good to kind of know how that operates or what other options are possible that you may care about, because if it's easy and people care about stealing things from the browser and they don't want to figure out how to code it themselves, but they can just drop this tool and do it for you or you themselves or whatever, I would expect to see that again. I did think the most interesting thing to me when it came to the anti-analyzing type behavior was looking what was the parent process that executed it. I thought that was kind of clever because I wouldn't think most people even think about that. And it is a huge telling sign. Like whatever is running the process sometimes can run things in certain ways to be able to do analysis. But also, you know, if you expect to fool somebody to run something or whatever that looks like, you know what that execution chain is going to look like. And so it's really easy for you to say, this isn't executed like the attack was designed, basically. Then you already know that maybe you don't want to run and you can avoid some of those things. So that part I thought was interesting, you know, using the WMIC, that's where they're figuring out, or WMI to figure out who the parent process was. And then, you know, like the easy things, like you kind of already mentioned, when you see other lol bins being executed and, you know, depending on what the parent is of those, I'm assuming it would be this application. It's not normal to see a lot of applications running that stat or task list and things like that. So depending on what the exe is, just paying attention to that relationship there. And if it, you know, especially if it's a non system 32, basically a Windows binary that's running those, because usually, you know, if you're running those, you could be running them from your command prompt. You could be running them from Explorer in some way or a run as or something like that. But that's going to come from the system 32 directory because it's built in functionality of Windows. And in this case, you see it executing outside of that. It's questionable, right? Some processes or, you know, really advanced software applications may try to leverage that in some instances, but it's not common. So yeah, those are some other key things that kind of stood out as well.
Yeah. I'm still, you know, was pretty blown away to see the level of depth they considered for those anti-aliasing stuff. Like the, when you're looking and tracking the duration of load time or execution time, like when you're going to that depth, you have very specific targets that you're trying to avoid, right? Like you have a pretty in-depth knowledge of what those sandbox environments might look like, which was pretty telling. But
yeah, I want to say there was one week where we talked about there was a specific malware that was executing in the sandbox and it was actually looking for specific host base names and usernames and then like specific files that existed in like a documents folder and things like that. And what's interesting, it's clearly a stealer that has landed in the sandbox environment so often that they now know that machine is a sandbox. And if it sees any of those artifacts that are associated with that machine, it's like, no, this isn't real.
It kind of gives me that feel like the attacker is tuning their you know, like we would tune the wool in a sim or something to avoid false positives. It's like, yeah, this isn't a true positive. This is the one we want. Yeah. So they're tuning their content around it, which is, it's cool.
Yeah, it's kind of fun to see stuff like that. So yeah, the last article is from eSecurity Planet. And this one I thought was really interesting because it's what is kind of on the top of mind of people in general of what kind of attacks associated with AI and, you know, what does that look like? What are people doing about it? And it is also interesting to me because it's the same problem we've had before AI existed on how attacks were being developed and then leveraged to some capacity. So it's titled AI Chatbots Exploited as Covert Gateways to Enterprise Systems. And basically, the chatbots that are being leveraged, they were using prompt injection and malform inputs to kind of help them create secret backdoors. So the campaign was first observed in mid-September of this year in 2025, and it was targeting enterprise LLMs or chatbot installations. They basically probed the chat system with malform prompts to basically glean internal implementation details. And this is the key point here. When they were doing certain prompts and probing, they were getting the chatbot to error and send error messages to the user, right? Interacting with it, which is like a huge no-no A user should never see, if they see any error message in general, it should have no details. If anything, just error should suffice. Because there's a lot of times where web applications, that's the same way how some of those get popped, right? They get this, oh, error, and they realize, oh, and it discloses some part of the backend database for the user table or something, because it discloses some information about that table. And now the attacker knows about this table and knows about these other details. So now when they profile a system or interact with it, they have more information to go off of. So that right there, I think, is the big lesson learned. It's not the AI component, but interestingly enough, the AI component is kind of the wrapper around this attack that kind of shows the capability it enables or how it's being leveraged. So they were able to embed indirect prompt injection payloads, which is interesting too, in like customer reviews and stuff like that. So they would subtly coerce the chatbot to divulge its internal system prompts and or configuration, which they're actually able to get API credentials exposed on operational logic and then, you know, the summarization of the pipelines. And so once they're able to have that internal context, the attackers can issue those unauthorized queries, you know, like let's list the stuff in a directory, you know, run those types of commands remotely, and then potentially retrieve information as well. And they also, doing the same mechanisms, were able to insert an obfuscated cron job that would trigger a reverse shell for even more access every time the logs were rotated. And, you know, one, regardless of how sophisticated them using the chat prompting that may not have the visibility people are paying attention to for those types of attacks, you should be paying attention to cron jobs on machines, especially Linux machines, because those themselves should not be going crazy and updating all the time either. And that would be pretty telling. The other thing they did, though, that was a little trickier, because they were able to identify they're running on a specific Python stack for some of the chatbots, they're able to then identify what Python modules potentially could exist that may or may not be active that they want to leverage for, you know, that reverse shell or some sort of callback or interactivity. And how they set it up was they would have these dormant malicious Python modules, right, that would activate when specific trigger phrases appeared in the chat traffic. So the LLM or the chat bot would, when it saw certain things, would enable those to kind of trigger them to execute and do whatever they're supposed to do, which is kind of an interesting thing in itself. But, you know, if you were to take the whole chatbot out of the equation and you replace this with vulnerable web app that we've been dealing with for the last 15 years, you know, attacker creating an error code, figuring out how to get access, drop certain things on the box to have cron jobs to do reverse shells, and potentially have certain things that you can basically query in the web address to basically cause something to execute to potentially do a reverse shell. That's kind of the same thing. And the only difference is you're kind of injecting the AI chatbot. And I would say the biggest challenge that probably exists there, like I mentioned earlier, was this visibility, right? Are you looking at how people are interacting to that degree, or can you, right? Versus web, you kind of can, but you kind of had the similar problems. A lot of people aren't looking at web app logs, stuff like that, maybe as detailed as they should as well. And that's why that was a great attack surface for kind of a similar thing. So yeah, I thought this was kind of fun to talk about. Clearly it's the same bad habits or bad design that's hitting basically new technologies that we should be paying attention to. Yeah, I was kind of curious what your thoughts were. Kind of interesting attack.
Yeah, it is pretty interesting. The first thing that I had was a bit of a PTSD reaction from the malformed packet kind of idea approach, the malformed prompt, you know.
Yeah.
I guess, you know, really as a thought experiment, and not to recklessly speculate, but I, you know, general conversation, Scott, what do you think is happening on the side of these chatbot tools, like from the, you know, the companies that are managing them or whatnot? Do you think they're taking this kind of stuff into consideration and building improvements around it? You know, maybe not just to not show the error code, but maybe consider how people are trying to prompt poison, or, you know, send these malformed prompts to kind of manipulate their system and, you know, build native or, you know, automatic defense against these kinds of things. I don't know. I always, when we see these, I always think, like, what are they trying to do to prevent this? What might they consider to prevent this, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of look at it from a, like, first to market problem. Because, you know, now when you look at a database admin or you look at a web app developer, that stuff's been around, and those positions have been around so long. And now, like, we're aware of the attacks. The companies actually look for people that have experience developing securely, right, for those types of things. There isn't really, since it's kind of a newer, like, if you're developing the chatbots and trying to deal with LLMs, people are more concerned about, can you do it, right, than, hey, you know, you have all the years of securing this to make this, you know, so that's kind of where we are, I think, because even when we were using databases heavily, the back end of web apps and in using web apps the way we were, they weren't all built very securely initially. There were some lessons learned, and we kind of go down that pathway. So I feel like that's kind of what's going to happen. I feel like we're going to see where, oh, maybe we should have a place where errors go. We don't disclose all this kind of stuff. Maybe when we implement this, we should have control over what files or data that this has access to. Or, you know, when it talks about looking at customer reviews, maybe, you know, you have different toggles to say, yeah, use this for information, but nothing else, right? Like, you know, don't take, you know, any guidance from maybe customer review type stuff. So I just don't think those controls have been, oh, and especially telemetry, right? They don't, people don't really know what is important. And just like anything that could have a lot of data, it's scary because they're like, well, that's, if it's going to be everywhere and we're going to use this in our environment everywhere for all sorts of functions, like, now how much storage and retention do we need? And how do we, and then this comes back to that same problem where it's like, well, since you can misspell things and it can interpret things correctly, and since you can say there's so many synonyms for so many different words, you can kind of say the same thing 100 different ways. How do you then detect that pattern without having another LLM to kind of do that same thing for you? You know, so yeah, I think we're just kind of that development life cycle where there's a lot of lessons learned. And unfortunately, we're kind of learning the same lessons we already know, but we have different developers that are growing up with this stuff, not having lived through all the development life cycles of, like, the professionals from the web app days and the database days, you know?
Yeah. And I feel almost like it's going to require some level of an LLM, or at least some level of a machine learning capability, to on the fly assess those inputs and then create context buckets and tagging and things like that to make decision markers, right? Because, like you said, the telemetry is so crazy, like, and there's so many variations, like, doing like a legacy thought process of just store logs kind of thing, it's probably not going to work for that kind of attack surface, right? Like, you're going to need to look at it. Like, AI is going to almost have to solve the problem. I just hope that there's, and then this is a bit of my ignorance because I'm just not sure if there are people out there that are doing this yet, but I'd have to imagine that maybe, but I hope there are people out there considering these problems on these tools to kind of help minimize the fallout of the speed to market process, like, on the back end, right? Because ideally it would be great as they're developing to consider these potential things, right, or tests. But we know for a fact through all of our years doing this, that's just rarely the case that that's done at a high effective level. So hopefully there's the, you know, somebody on the back end looking to try to shore that up a little bit.
Yeah. And I think what's interesting about these attacks too is, like, people sometimes will freak out, like, oh, you can do this with this. And it's like, yeah, but I mean, it's just like, you know, going on your first date or trying to get your first date with somebody, there's no one liner that does that for you typically. Like, I don't think there's that Fabio for LLMs that can just make an LLM do what they want immediately. Right. It's more like persistence. I'm going to talk about this. I'm going to try to get this. I'm going to edge this. So like the number of interactions you have to have, I think, would be far higher than the average person. So even just looking at things like that alone might be of interest, right? Because we're not there yet where someone can just whisper the perfect thing and all of a sudden everyone's like, I'm under your control, you know? So yeah, I feel like getting a little further away from like the Skynet, you know, phobia to like, okay, yeah, people have to still work really hard. And it's like, you know, it's like the dorky guy trying to get the hot girl out on a date. There's persistence there. And I think that's something that people pay attention to what that looks like. Might help shed some light without having to worry about as much of the data problems we currently have.
Yeah, makes sense.
Cool. Well, that closes out this weekly segment. There's one mention. I will be hosting a threat hunting management workshop. It's going to be talking about the business value of threat hunting. It's going to be a little different than what a lot of people and what we've talked about in the past from the security perspective. I'm going to try to talk about from an organizational business perspective. So hopefully there's some insightful things there. I mean, it's management based stuff, so it will be kind of like a lot of talking. But that'll be October 29th. And it's just going to be a 30-minute session from 12 to 12:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So with that, I want to thank everyone for joining our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast. Looking forward to syncing back up next week. And with that, it closes out our top threat hunting headlines for the week of October 13th, 2025. Happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everyone.